You probably know by now, during these 40 days of Lent, we are camping in the story of the prodigal son, this best known of all of the parables of Jesus. You know, there's a way of reading scripture, and it is a meaningful way, that is a little bit like observing beauty while you're driving along the interstate. You're zipping along at 70 miles an hour, and you are indeed observing the beauty that is around you, but you see it as you do when you're going 70 miles an hour. There's a way of reading the Bible like that, reading a great deal in a short period of time. There's much to be gained by that approach. But there's also a way of reading the Bible that's like getting out of the car and walking over to the trailhead and walking slowly along the lane and looking at every tree and every flower and noticing all of the flora and the fauna. And that's what we want to do during these 6 weeks with the parable of the prodigal son. We're going to just camp here for a while and listen to this extraordinarily rich story that was told by Jesus. If you haven't noticed, we have some paintings that have been placed, copies of paintings that have been placed in various places out in the narthex and one out here at the back of the sanctuary. These are various artists' renditions of the return of the prodigal. I hope that you'll just stop and ponder some of them. I think that you'll find that they'll speak to you. Last Sunday morning, we picked up the beginning of this story. Jesus said there was a man who had two sons. The elder son said to his father, "Father, give me my share of the estate." And so his father did. And the younger son took all that he had and went into a distant country. And there he squandered his wealth in reckless and wild living. And then there was a famine in that land. And after he had spent everything that he had, there was absolutely nothing left whatsoever. He then found that he hungered for the food that he had been feeding to the pigs that he'd been hired out to feed. And it is this part of the story that we're going to pick up this morning, once again focusing on the younger son. Jesus said, when he came to his senses, he said, "How many of my father's hired men have food to spare, and here I am starving to death." Well, leave it to a master storyteller like Jesus to say so much with so little. This little phrase that we have in front of us, when he came to his senses. Literally, the Greek of this passage says, when he came to himself. When the younger son came to himself. How do you come to yourself? Well, to come to yourself, you have to be apart from yourself. And what a picture of who this younger son is. A piece of him is over here, and a piece of him is over here, and a part of his splintered self is over here, and a part of his splintered self is over here. And all of these parts of his splintered self aren't really who he is. And in this moment of the story, he becomes one. He becomes one indivisible person. When he came to himself, he saw his situation and his circumstances and himself as they really were, and what he saw was not attractive. His glasses of deceit have been removed. His pretentiousness has been taken away. He is now robbed of all of these things, and sheer hunger has left him a person who is one indivisible whole, observing his reality as it is. And here's his reality. He is hungry. He is aching, starving, burning, hungry. He longs to eat the food that has been provided for the pigs, and yet there is no one to give even that to him now. He's hungry. He's the guy whose pressed shirts and his starched pants are hanging in somebody else's closet now. Now he's wearing rags that he picked up secondhand from the Salvation Army thrift store. He's running about in threadbare clothes. He's the fellow who has galvanized the gossip in the community. In the coffee shops and in the bars, he's the one that everybody's talking about now. "Hey, did you hear about that kid from Judea? The one who came here with the bucket loads of money? Doesn't have anything left now. He's sleeping on the side of the gutter. Poor kid." He's the one whose life is being spent in the foul odors of bodies that are unkept and animals that are unclean, and he is homeless. He's homeless. That is the reality of his situation. In the time of Jesus, they had a word for this. We call it homeless. In the day of Jesus, they had a slightly different word. The word was exile. Say the word terrorist in today's world, and all of our blood pressure goes up, and there is a freeze in the emotion of all of us. Say the word exile to Jews in the day of Jesus, and the same sort of thing, I suspect, would take place. This was an awful, horrible, dirty word. To be an exile was to be severed from your home. It was to be cut off from the place and the people of your own dwelling. And to be an exile was to be cut off from your true self, from who you really are, so that you are a pretentious, scattered, leftover bit, and you're not who you really are. And folks, this fellow is in exile. He is cut off from his home, cut off from family and from place, and he's cut off from who he really is. He's been spread about in all kinds of different places. This is a fellow who's absolutely, positively in exile now. And here's where this story gets a little dicey. Jesus is telling this story to a people who are in exile. You see, the Jewish world of the first century to whom Jesus was telling this story are people who aren't literally cut off from their homeland, but believe me, friends, they are not home. Remember, Jesus is telling this story to tax collectors and to sinners and to Pharisees and to scribes and to disciples, all of them Jewish men and women and children, and they are not home. Believe me, they are not home. They may live in their own land, but Roman soldiers who are roaming their streets and shouting out their belligerent and braggadocious language are a constant reminder that they are not home. Oh, it's their home, but it's not their home. You understand? They lived there, but it's not their land any longer. Every time they go on a journey and they need to walk from one village to another village and they have to push their way past a tax collector who's going to shake them down for everything that they're worth and pass that money along to the Roman government, every time they take a journey, they're reminded this is not their home. It gets colder. Did you know that in the time of Jesus, when Jesus was perhaps a young man, there was a group of Jewish people who created, organized an insurrection. They decided that they were so tired of being in their own land but not being home that they created an insurrection and they formed a little army and they decided they were going to go up against the Roman Empire and they were going to conquer the empire and finally they were going to be at home. And yet, you probably could have guessed, they were just quickly and easily destroyed. And Roman government took their bodies and placed them on crosses along the sides of roads between the villages and left their bodies there to rot as a constant sign to the men and the women and the children that they were not home. Jesus is telling this story to people who are in exile. And here's where it gets even dicier. He's telling this story to people who are not being who they are. The Jewish nation, a people created by God, a people called by God, people called to be in a covenant relationship with God, chosen to be a special people in the world by God, people called to live in this relationship with God, which would then live in a reflection to the love of God for all of the world. God's people called to be a light to the nations, and they were not being who they were by creation and by calling. I want to remind you, Jesus told the story of the prodigal son while he was on his way journeying from Galilee to Jerusalem. This is important. Jesus was beginning in Galilee, and he was on this long journey toward Jerusalem where we know that the cross awaited him at the far end of this journey. Jesus was on his way to Jerusalem. Now, this is important. Jerusalem was the home of the greatest dreams and ambitions of the Jewish nation. This was the place where the temple resided. The greatest symbol of the place where heaven and earth connect with one another was the temple in first century Judaism. This was the home and the seat of their greatest hopes. Many Jewish men and women and children believed that Messiah was going to come. And when Messiah came, he was going to rule from Jerusalem, from this place. He was going to overcome all of their opponents. He was going to overthrow the Romans. And from this place, they would be home once again. This was the seat of their highest dreams and ambitions. And Jesus, instead of coming and fulfilling all of the ambitions of the people, Jesus, on the way to Jerusalem, spoke the harshest and sharpest words of critique of that city that he ever spoke. Remember, he's on his way from Galilee to Jerusalem now with disciples. And on the way, he stops and he says, with a note of real sarcasm, "O Jerusalem, how could any of your prophets be murdered except in Jerusalem?" Ouch. It's on this journey toward Jerusalem that Jesus stops. Listen to the tenderness of these words. Jesus says, "O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, how many times I would have gathered your children together as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, but you would not." It is when Jesus finally arrives in Jerusalem, when the people lay down their palm branches in front of him, some of them recognizing him to be the king who is arriving. It is the very next day that Jesus goes to the temple, the seat of the greatest hopes and ambitions of the Jewish nation. Jesus goes to the temple, and instead of there being coronated as the king, he walks through as an act of God's judgment. He walks through and he turns over all of the tables and he announces, "This is my Father's house, a place of prayer, and you have turned it into a den of robbers." Jesus will speak his sharpest comments toward the leaders of the Jerusalem religious institution, priests and leaders. Jesus will say of them, "You have been called to live out God's law, the big things of the law, and instead you've gotten caught up in all the little nitty-gritty tiny details when you're supposed to be about justice and mercy and showing God's justice and mercy and love to all of the world. Instead, you're standing in front of your mirrors and you're singing, 'My phylacteries are longer than your phylacteries.'" Yeah. And the sharpest, most stinging critiques are spoken by Jesus on his way to Jerusalem. Do you understand why? Because they had forgotten who they were. They had forgotten that they were the covenant people of God. They had forgotten that they were called to live in a living relationship with God. They had forgotten that they were called to be a light to the whole world. They weren't being themselves. So, it is in that context that Jesus told this story about the younger son who is cut off from his home and his place, and he is cut off from who he really is, and he's telling it to a nation who is cut off from their home, and they are cut off from who they really are. It is a people in exile who hear this story. There's a wonderful minister who has made this statement that has now become known fairly well. Frederick Buechner has said, "The gospel is bad news before it is good news. The gospel is bad news before it is good news." In fact, I wonder if we could go even a step further, and I wonder if we could say, if people have not heard the gospel as really, really good news, and I mean, if people haven't heard the gospel of Jesus as the kind of news that makes you want to stand up and jump right out of your shoes, it might be because they have never first heard the stinging word that the gospel of Jesus speaks. We are now in this season that we call Lent, and the burden of this season of Lent is to remind the church of the cost to God of our reconciliation. But the burden of Lent is also to remind us of the cost to us of being followers in the way of Jesus. The burden of Lent is to help us to recognize our own exiles. Now, I need to tell you that I haven't always been a fan of Lent. There was a time years ago when I first became a Christian, the Church of God that I attended didn't practice Lent. I don't know if any Church of God congregations did back at that time, 800 years ago. The time that I became a Christian, the Church of God did not practice Lent, and so for many, many years I didn't practice Lent, and I just sort of thought that Lent was something for people that were stuck in tradition and people that were stuck in ritual. I sort of had my nose up in the air and a little arrogantly about this whole business of Lent. I guess you could say that I would have, in those days, I would have called it the Lent trap. But something happened to change that for me, and what happened was, to be very honest, the Bible. I was listening to a teacher whom I highly respect, and this teacher whom I highly respect was pointing out something that I should have known. I had read it many, many, many times for myself. I should have known this, but I had never noticed. This teacher noted that one-third of the story of the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke in particular, one-third of the story of Jesus that is told in Matthew, Mark, and Luke is telling the story of the last week of the life of Jesus. Now, I know I've told you that before, but I'm going to ask you to let that just sink in for a moment, would you? One-third of Matthew, Mark, and Luke is devoted to the last week of the life of Jesus. There are so many things that we would have liked the gospel writers to have told us, wouldn't we? Wouldn't you have liked for the gospel writers to tell us more about the childhood of Jesus? Don't you wish they'd have told you stories about what kind of games he played when he was a kid or what kind of a child he was like? Don't you wish the gospel writers would have told us what Jesus looks like? Wouldn't you like to know what color his hair was or how tall he was or what his sandals were like? Aren't there just hundreds of things that you would like to know about Jesus that the gospel writers just didn't bother to tell us? But what they did tell us is fascinating. They told us very little about the first 30 years of Jesus' life. Most of the first two-thirds of the stories of Matthew, Mark, and Luke are about 3 years in the life of Jesus. This whole long part of the Gospels is about 3 years in the life of Jesus. And then, one-third of the Gospels is about the last week of Jesus. Do you get the impression that they're trying to tell us something? Like, church, don't ever, 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 under any circumstances, forget the cost to God of our reconciliation. 1 week, one-third, telling the movement of Jesus toward the cross, don't ever forget the cost to God. If you do, all will be lost. But I also think from Matthew, Mark, and Luke, we learn that one-third of the gospel devoted to the last week of Jesus reminds us of the cost to us of being followers in the one who was crucified. Part of the business of Lent is to remind the church of the cost of belonging to Jesus. And part of that cost is to have the courage to reflect on our own exiles. You know, I don't know about you. I couldn't spend 365 days a year reflecting on the ways that I am in exile. That would be far too painful, far too heavy to do that for 365 days a year. But I am so grateful for 40 days in which, in the wisdom of the church, we're asked to come back and remember the ways that we are severed from home and the ways that we are severed from our true selves. I don't know about you, but when I look around today, I believe I see people in exile. I believe I see people, including myself, who are in exile from their home. I believe I see exile where I see a lack of real joy, the deep and abiding and authentic joy, and instead we find flitty little ways to find happiness for a few moments. But I believe I see exile in a lack of real joy. I believe I see exile in a lack of genuine laughter. There isn't nearly enough of it. Have you noticed how much of it is artificial? How much we have to turn to the television and the comedians these days because we don't know how to find deep, genuine, powerful laughter in life where it really belongs. I believe I see exile where there is a lack of real communion with and appreciation for beauty. We don't know how any longer to just stop and appreciate the power of beauty, the overwhelming power of beauty. Instead, we stare at screens where somebody one day took a picture of something that was beautiful. I believe I see exile in people who are living in fear, fear of today, fear of tomorrow, fear for our children, fear for the economy, fear for the country, fear for the future. I believe I see people in exile who live in fear. I believe I see exile where I see people who, who are living in stress that has taken hold of their bodies, stress that if they're quiet for even just a moment, they become aware is almost always there, stress in the neck and stress in the headache and stress in the stomach and stress everywhere. If they're quiet for even just a moment, they become aware that they are so exceedingly anxious. I believe that's exile. I believe that I see exile where I see people who treat their bodies as commodities. People who throw around their bodies as though they are not holy things, and they treat their sexuality as though it is something that is insignificant. I believe I see exile where I see people who cannot sit still or be quiet. Do you hear how strange that is? It has been so extraordinarily easy for humans of most generations to sit still and be quiet and listen, but not for us. Perhaps it is because we're afraid that when we do, our bodies are going to tell us just how anxious we are. And so we avoid it with busyness and noise and activity and to-do lists that never end. I believe that I see exile in people who are so chronically anxious that they have become addicted to control. They are trying to control situations, and they try to control circumstances, and there is a never-ending activity and anxiousness in which they're trying to control other people and all things, everything except themselves. They have lost control of themselves as they're trying to control everything else. I believe that I see exile where I see people who are living here and here and here and here and here in their efforts to find happiness, and they have not discovered that it's going to have to come here. I believe that I see exile when I see people who are living without roots, where spirituality has replaced a deep-rootedness in God. Spirituality, which can be anything, whatever it happens to be, to a particular person at a particular time. And lost completely is a history, a tradition of people who have learned to walk with God and to be part of that people. I believe I see exile in a nation that has become so violent. We are so violent with our words, with our actions, with our vindictiveness. We are violent to children. We are violent to adults. We are violent to the unborn. We are such a violent nation. I believe that I see in these things evidence of people who are in exile. We are severed from home. And I believe I see evidence that we are severed from our true self as well. We are severed from who we were created and called to be. I believe that churches are too often replacing the journey of transformation to which we have been called, the journey of transformation where we are continually being changed into the likeness of Jesus. I believe that we have replaced the journey of transformation with the path of least resistance. We've replaced worship with entertainment. Let's see, had a nice beat, had a nice sound, I'll give it a 7.2. And too often, I believe, we have replaced service to the world with service of self. And so we are severed from home and we are severed from our true selves. I believe I see individuals, all kinds of evidence of individuals who are in exile and who have been severed from their true selves. People who have no idea what the drumbeat of their heart is telling them. They haven't listened carefully enough to the voice of the Spirit who is working within them. They have no clue where God is leading. And people who are lost in their efforts to be loved and their efforts to experience empowerment and their efforts to be safe and have given themselves to 1,000 different lovers. Friends, I believe today we need to have the courage to stop and look and peek at the ways that we are in exile. Like the younger son, like the people who lived at the time of Jesus. Frederick Buechner said the gospel has to be bad news before it can be good news. I believe that. I believe that we need to hear its sting before we can hear its good news. And Lent is a time for hearing its sting. But we would be remiss this morning if we did not also say that the gospel has to be bad news before it can be good news. And let me tell you something. It is really, really, really good to those who have had the courage to hear its sting. It's good already in this story, and we haven't even gotten to the good part yet. It's good already in this story. Jesus said, when he came to himself, do you hear this? When this scattered young man, who was many severed little parts of selves, none of which were really who he was, when he came to himself, the story's already good. He becomes one indivisible person, finally. This scattered, fractured young man finally becomes one whole person, and he acknowledges the situation in which he's living. He looks around and he says, oh my gosh, my father's hired hands have food enough to eat and to spare, and here I am starving to death in a foreign land. I know what I need to do. I finally know what I need to do. I need to go home. It's time to go home. And it's time to tell the truth for a change. And so he prepares these words that he's going to speak to his father when he finally gets home. By the way, none of these words are exaggerated. They are simply the truth of his situation. He decides that he will say, Father, I have sinned against heaven and I have sinned against you. No exaggeration whatsoever. By the way, he didn't say, Father, I've made some mistakes. I've made a couple of errors in judgment. No. He uses a far more powerful word than that. I have sinned against heaven and against you. I have missed the mark. My whole life has missed the target. I am completely off guard. Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. Listen to these words. They are not an exaggeration. They are his truth. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Because he isn't. He's treated his father as though his father is dead. He's run off and ruined his life. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. You know, the beauty of this story is we haven't even touched on the great part yet. The great part is that there is a party that is awaiting when he sets off on the journey toward home. There's going to be a moment when his father recognizes the younger son coming. Younger son doesn't know that this is coming yet. There's going to be a moment when father is going to race down the road and he's going to throw his arms around his son. And he's going to put a ring on his finger and a robe on his back, and he's going to welcome his son home with an extraordinary celebration. By the way, welcome back, kids. We welcome you back with arms wide open. If we had a ring and a robe, we'd give it to you. I would like to tell you what I believe to be one of the most beautiful words of the English language. One of the most beautiful words of the English language, I believe, is this word right here. Repent. You won't find that word in this story. It's not in there. But this story is really a description of what that word means. That beautiful, beautiful New Testament word literally means a change of mind, a whole change of mind. And it is what is being narrated by Jesus in the telling of this story. This young man turns toward home. He has the courage at last to tell the truth. During this season of Lent, I want to ask you to summon the courage to tell the truth. I want to ask you during these 40 days moving up toward the cross of Jesus to reflect on your life and ask, where am I in exile? In what ways have I completely missed the path? How am I severed from my true home in God? And how have I become severed from the person that God created and called me to be? One way that you might want to do this is by taking up the practice of writing a journal. If you don't do this already, if you have not started, it's as simple as pulling up a page on your desktop, on your desktop, or pulling up a spiral notebook and just begin writing and ask the question, where am I in exile today? In what ways am I severed from home by my own choices? And in what ways am I severed from who I really am because of my choices? And what does it mean for me to begin to return home? Because here's the wonderful news. As we turn home, there is a welcome awaiting us that is greater than anything we had ever imagined. In fact, the welcome might look a little bit and sound a little bit like this song.